Good morning. I hope you're having a fine Sunday morning. Welcome back to another edition of Miami Valley Voices on this Cox radio station. I am your host, as usual, from the Dayton Daily News, Ron Rollins. And we are in the studio today to talk about history, very interesting history, with a return guest, Paul Lockhart, who is a history professor at Wright State University and a member of the Dayton History Board of Trustees. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Ron. Thanks for having me on.
Well, absolutely. We want to remind folks, you were here about a year and a half ago to talk about World War One, when the beginning of the centennial started back in 2014, and you're back to talk about World War One, but in particular the exhibit that just opened at Carolyn Historical Park that has to do with the war. Tell us about it. You curated it, helped assemble it, put it all together.
Well, I did a fair amount of that, but not the real heavy lifting.
Okay, take the credit. That's Mary won't mind. Yeah.
Well, it grew out of, when I was here a year and a half ago, I was talking about the centennial programming that we had gone on to Wright State in 2014. It was planning at that moment for Wright State for 2014-2015.
Right, yeah.
In collaboration with Celia.
Remind people what Celia is at Wright
Celia
State.
Celia is the Ohio Center of Excellence for Collaborative Education, Leadership, and Innovation in the Arts.
There you go. Right. Yeah. The school made a big deal out of the centennial.
We had a concert series. We had a couple of lectures that we had a week in March where it peaked with production of Britain's War Requiem,
which was the
Philharmonic,
and which featured your brother,
my brother Keith Lockhart, conductor of the Boston Pops, and BBC Concert Orchestra.
Right. There was an exhibit at the war posters at the DAI.
Last summer.
So
at the time I talked about this with Brady Kress at Carillon about the
people on this show know Brady.
He's a great asset to the community.
Oh yeah.
At that point, about doing something highlighting Dayton's role in the First World War, which was one of the things that propelled this. Honestly, not only because Americans in general tend to forget. Though the American participation in World War One was short.
Right.
I mean, less than a year and a half total and combat operations and really only a couple of months.
Right.
It nonetheless was very important for the war, and the war was very important for the United States.
Sure.
It shaped it. And I don't think you see that anywhere better than you see it in Dayton.
And tell why. That's interesting.
Well, first of all, when I first, because one of the other manifestations of this this commemoration is a film that I'm writing right now on Dayton's role in the war.
Okay.
My idea was to write about America in the war, but from Dayton's perspective. And the rationale behind that is, first of all, everything I'd want to talk about in telling the story of America in the First World War can be found in Dayton, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
The major industrial contribution, because Dayton, while it might not have been the largest heavy manufacturing city in the world, was certainly one of the one of the biggest centers of high tech.
Right,
and that's clear here.
As it was defined at the time.
As it was defined at the time, meaning early flight, only a little more than a decade after the flight of Kitty Hawk.
Right.
The very first tanks and optics and things like that. But many of the other aspects, the role the war played in civil rights, in women's rights, are all manifest in Dayton. The fact that Dayton had a large German-American population, and the war, the war presents really the first time that Americans are in this case, that the government actually encourages a certain amount of intolerance, towards, in this case, towards German Americans.
Gosh, what does that sound like today?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yes.
Hmm.
Yeah. There's a lot of contemporary residence to this.
Yeah, there is a great deal, actually.
Yeah.
Well, and with the Japanese during World War II,
exactly.
Later on,
and that's it's one of the things I found most interesting with this, the way that. German Americans and Austrian Americans were treated in the First World War.
Right.
The shadows you see moving towards the interment of Japanese Americans in a second.
And the conversation about Muslim Americans today.
Yes,
absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So basically all the elements, all the things that I would want to tell about the America in the First World War and the First World War's impact on America are found in Dayton.
Plus, it was the time at which Dayton was still kind of the center of the universe in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the amount of work that was being done here, that was not least of which was the Wright brothers.
Oh, yeah.
But all the Delco and GM and all that stuff.
And the First World War helped to bolster build all that, stuff, so right. so then it becomes the the giant that it is in the Second World War.
You said there's a film you're working on or a book?
Yeah,
You have numerous books out.
Yes, thanks. Okay. Yeah, I do. On but so far they've like my first four with Scandinavian history and two on the Revolution. And I'm working one on the Revolution now.
Oh really? Wait, side note, what about?
About the Battle of Saratoga.
Oh really? Benedict Arnold's big battle, or
Certainly
that's where he got wounded.
He got wounded in the leg.
Right? Yep, isn't there a statue?
There's a statue of his boot,
memorializing his boot
with his name on it.
I've never been, but I've read about that. And what was the who was the German taskmaster that you read about the book?
Steuben.
That helped Valley Forge. That's the one I've read. It's a really good book.
Thanks.
Go out and buy the books. They're available on Amazon. Just look up Paul Lockhart. And we're here with Paul Lockhart from Wright State talking about World War One and the Carolyn Park exhibition about it. So you kind of from all that early conversation, this idea kind of germinated and flourished to have a more permanent semi-permanent exhibition over at Carillon Park.
Yes, it started with a long phone conversation between me and Brady probably 2 years ago, and we just discussed it. Then Brady thought it was something an aspect of the Dayton story that we don't think of very often.
Right. World War II gets focused on
a lot. And understandably, Americans in general tend to focus on World War II. We think of it as our war in a way that we don't think of the First World War as our war.
Right.
But when it was obvious, to him as it was to me, that there were so many things about Dayton changed in the war.
Right.
Besides the fact that Dayton's contribution was great, that it really merited something. Right. So from that point on, it really became a matter of a search for artifacts, of which there were a lot.
I'm sure.
Many of which were in the collections for Memorial Hall.
Right.
Between Mary Oliver and Gwen Haney and my graduate assistants.
With curators at Dayton History,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And my graduate assistants at the War and Society concentration at Wright State. Were able to find. I mean, some treasures like Edward Deeds' tunic.
I
had no idea that was. You pull out a tunic and there's Deeds' name.
That's cool.
A name tag on it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, let's tell people right quick where the exhibition is. It's at Dayton History in the back of the Family Learning Center.
Yes, the back of the Family Learning Center.
Behind the carousel.
Behind the carousel, a temporary exhibit.
And it's going to be up through
November 11th of 2018. Excuse me, 2018.
The duration of the rest of the anniversary of the war.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So it'll officially end on Armistice Day, the 100th day of.
So, dear listeners, there's no excuse not to see something that's going to be up until November of 1918. Okay, go see it. It's a really good exhibition, actually.
Well, thanks.
Yeah,
thanks.
Really cool. So tell people what they'll see other than Edward Deeds tunic.
Well, what we try to do, and I wrote the text for the exhibit, and I worked out the initial plan with Gwen Haney at Dayton History. Gwen turned that plan essentially into reality. Is a kind of a chronological look at Dayton at the war. As you first get in, you first come into the exhibit, you get a glimpse of what life was like in Dayton in 1914, reminding people that it was a very diverse population, with large German, Hungarian, Lithuanian, Polish populations, especially in the north, and how America became involved in the war. And then looking at the war on the home front, how conscription worked, how the National Guard was mobilized, the industrial contribution, the contributions of people like John Patterson and Edward Deeds.
On that home front aspect, did the country in any way mobilize on a level akin to what people are familiar with in World War II?
Yes, and at that point it was unprecedented. Yeah. It was the biggest war effort to date in American history.
Okay,
and ultimately, we sent close to 2 million men overseas in a very short period of time.
Right,
it's a gargantuan effort, and of course that's one of the themes is it requires the federal government to step in a way that it never had before in American life.
Right.
So all those themes are highlighted. The fact that we have this whole new slew of government organizations.
Big government.
The United States Food Administration, which is telling people to meatless Mondays and wheatless Wednesdays and to save their fats for fighters. The Committee on Public Information. I mean, all sorts of government agencies whose purpose is to raise morale, to mobilize resources and manpower for the war.
But who also had the unexpected, well, possibly unexpected, ramification of affecting lifestyle decisions for the first time probably that the government had done that. What you eat, what's available for you to purchase when you eat it, you know, how you react to your neighbors, stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, in that one in particular, it really is the first time that the government tells us what to think.
Right.
And while dissent had been possible in earlier American conflicts, this is possible to disagree with the conflict, and the Mexican-American War is a great example.
Right.
Possible to disagree with that without being branded a traitor.
Right.
It's really not possible to disagree with the war effort without being branded a traitor in the First World War.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And numerous examples in Dayton, one of which we brought up was the so-called teacher trial, where several German language or language teachers or teachers of German descent were essentially put on trial in front of the Board of Education in the summer of 1918 for being pro-German and entirely on hearsay. Before the war, German was the only foreign language taught in Dayton public schools.
Yeah.
And after 1918, it was completely dropped. And burnings of German language books. And it's really a scary climate.
Is that when French became prevalent?
Yeah, French and Spanish were being taught.
That's fascinating.
As a result,
that's
a substitute for German.
Yeah.
So from there and from training, highlight in particular the number of Dayton-based units like Battery D-134 Field Artillery.
And is that the one that's marching down Main Street? There's a great photo, a big photo.
Oh, in uniform?
Of guys in uniform, and they all have
The Buckeye
on their helmet.
That's actually the 148th Infantry, which is in the 37th Division.
It's a fabulous photo.
Division.
They're going right down Main Street.
Yeah. It is after they'd come home. They had the digital symbols painted on their helmets. That was one of the groups that was local. Battery D of the 134th Field Artillery was a National Guard unit. They're the ones whose monument is at the Ridge Avenue Bridge.
Oh, okay.
By Triangle Park.
Okay.
In fact, they did their initial training at what was called Camp Triangle.
Right. And there's still a cannon up there.
There's a French 75 there, and there's a plaque listing the members of Battery D.
Right. Okay.
And there's some neat photos too of them actually standing in front of that kind of mound there. Past the ball field.
Right.
A number of groups were essentially made up of Dayton men, and then we take them overseas.
Yeah.
And one of the more visually compelling parts of the exhibit is a trench, which was Brady's idea. And
the
was
trench
a
is
great
really
idea.
Cool.
It is cool. Yeah, it was just meant to be. We had to cut out some of the features that would have made it completely authentic, like a firing step, because they would have been kind of dangerous.
Right. Or blood and rats.
Things that lead to
disgusting
trench
smells.
Yeah. Corpses.
Yes. And things.
So we.
The trenches must have just simply been god awful horrible.
Oh, yeah. But what I like about that display is that, because it essentially functions as a passageway from at home to over there.
Right. You have to walk. You walk in a big circle around.
You walk through
the trench and end up at the end.
Exactly.
Right,
yeah. And then you're in Europe.
Right.
Is that it suggests the scale of it. And it's one thing we often don't appreciate.
Good
is
point.
The scale of these trenches.
Right.
And so once you pass through there, then you're over there. And then we profile individual units in the war.
Over there.
Individual units. And a few individual Daytonians who had neat stories to tell.
That's neat. How's the trench? Tell people how the trench is made. It's kind of give us a little bit behind the scenes.
I saw it bits and pieces. I remember it was in March, walking in there and there's the big open exhibit gallery with virtually nothing in it and a wall on the ground
where
it had been cut out. Essentially, it's a it's wall that's been faced with a frame to give it a little bit of a slant, and then faced with sawn timber. With rough cut boards.
Okay.
There are many forms of trench construction, but that's one we found that was especially common.
Right, that's interesting. So talk a little bit more about the whole, all the ways that the city and the country were changed by the war. So you touched on a couple, the civil rights and some other things.
Right.
What did Dayton look like physically between the beginning of the war and the end of the war? Were there physical changes people would have noticed or massive changes in the industrial base or did the city grow?
The city grew.
Yeah.
Became wealthier.
Okay.
It certainly was a huge influx of workers into the city.
Okay.
There was definitely a housing shortage,
mm-hmm.
and in fact, a couple of Dayton women's organizations bought up Mm-hmm. Bought up a number of houses to serve as essentially mm-hmm. boarding houses for young single working women. Mm-hmm. But the large employers, not just NCR, the obvious ones, but mm-hmm. Flatiron Works, right. Maxwell Motor Car, which we don't. I mean, it's right. a kind of a blip in our history, but right. Maxwell Motor Car had four gigantic plants in Dayton right. during the war, one of which was devoted over to tank production.
Okay,
the war.
Right. Remind people of that. They built tanks here.
Dayton was, as the Dayton Daily News put it proudly but correctly,
right.
Dayton was the tank center of the nation in World War
I. We'd like to get it right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the most heavy equipment that was needed for the war... American troops borrowed from the French or the British.
Right.
As one way of speeding up the transition of troops right. over there.
So the tanks that were built here never got used in combat?
Probably not.
Yeah,
for the most part,
right.
not. I mean, the production just started too late.
Right.
Americans used large numbers of a French light tank, the Renault FT-17, and that became the basis for the U.S. Model 1917 tank.
Mm-hmm.
Three assembly points in the United States, mm-hmm. One in Cleveland and two in Dayton, Maxwell mm-hmm. Motor Car and mm-hmm. Platt Iron Works.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two produced more than 2/3 of the tanks made from the
right.
summer of 1918 until a few months after the armistice.
Now, and we should tell people, if you're just tuning in, this is Miami Valley Voices. This is Ron Rollins, your host. We're here with Paul Lockhart, Wright State History Professor and a member of the Dayton History Board of Trustees, talking about the Carillon Historical Park World War I exhibit, which will be up now through, opened 2 weeks ago, right?
Yeah. Opened, yeah, yeah.
2 weeks ago. Up through November of 2018, I'm sorry, the centennial of the end of World War I. And it's a really cool exhibit. Last time you were here, a year and a half ago, talking about all this, and I think Brady mentioned too, you guys did try to get a tank, didn't you?
Yes, we did. We tried very hard.
Are there many left?
There are a few. There's a couple dozen
yeah.
that exist in the United States or abroad that are actually American made.
I think I saw one at Fort Knox years ago.
Yes, there was. It was right at the entrance to the museum.
An armor museum.
And
that's
been moved
right.
since. I mean, since the Army has changed its museum. There's one at the Rocky Army Museum in Indiana.
Okay.
There's one at Rhinebeck Aerodrome in New York. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. And some of them are just rotting. They're rusting outside of VFW posts around the country.
Okay.
But yeah, certainly there are number quite a few of them, and several of them I know are Dayton right. made.
And they weren't very big.
No, they're a two-man tank.
Well,
even then, they're small.
Right. Well, and when we picture tanks, with a revolving turret, a gun, what you picture from World War II and beyond, these looked more like shoeboxes with cleats kind of on the side.
Right. But this, though, the FT-17 actually had a turret. In fact, that's one thing that made it quite kind of modern.
A
prototype for later tanks after the war.
I didn't realize that. Okay.
Where most of the heavy tanks, like the British and Germans, look, the German A7V, for example, look like a barn. And British tanks tended to be... also very blocky.
Right.
This is very small
mm-hmm.
and has a manually revolving turret with either a 37mm gun or a single machine gun.
Okay.
One driver and one gunner.
Right.
The armor is enough to protect the operators from small arms fire, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did tanks end up playing much of a role in the war?
Actually, yes.
Really?
I mean, not only the fact. I mean, granted, not decisive, but they.
Yeah.
Certainly in 1917, 1918, a number of actual tank battles. Sometimes the tanks were
right.
used in offensives,
right.
and one of the interesting links that I liked with this in terms of Dayton
mm-hmm.
was that a captain in one of the first tank regiments in the U.S. Army Tank Corps
mm-hmm.
Was Daytonian. Well, from Centerville.
Yeah.
In fact, we profile him there.
He wrote
a book about it.
I remember that now. Yeah, right.
Edward Kiever, who is from the son of the Centerville town doctor.
Right.
I love that, seeing how many medical offices
right.
are in Centerville now. Centerville had a town doctor in 1917.
Yeah, 1917, Centerville was miles and miles and miles.
Oh, yeah. It was remote, and it was a little farming community.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Kiever ended up, at first, as an ambulance driver, volunteered for the tank corps, and then fought in the San Miguel and Meuse-Argonne offensives.
Right.
And the book, he wrote a novel about it, but it's quite autobiographical,
right.
and it's hard reading.
Yeah.
I mean, in the sense that it really, really some nasty stuff.
Right.
After the war, I became a reporter actually for the Journal Herald. And
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I will have to look more closely. I should say I was through the exhibit on opening night for the reception,
yeah.
and I haven't had a chance to go back and really drill into it. And it was pretty busy that night.
There was hard to see.
Four or 500 people there.
Yes.
And it was hard to see stuff. I remember The Tunic, but I forgot it was Deeds, for example.
Yes,
so
yes.
I need to go back and really drill into it. Was there anything that you learned from all this? You were already pretty much an authority on the war when you dug into this. Is there anything? Were there any aha moments for Paul?
Well, you know,
this?
There's the industrial contribution, which I had underestimated before I got working on it. Another thing that kind of surprised me. Maybe surprise isn't the right word, but as somebody who's not native to Dayton, but lived in Dayton nearly his entire adult life, Dayton, the degree of the size of the art and vitality of the artistic community, for example, here has always been a pleasant surprise to me. But to see how in Dayton in 1917 was already pretty wealthy, wealthier after the war. Dayton's heyday is certainly right afterwards, but. But quite sophisticated, and just getting an idea of what cultural life was like to see how often people like Pablo Casals or Enrique Caruso or Leopold Stokowski were coming to Dayton to give guest performances.
That's
on basically every year. The size of the progressive political movements in Dayton, especially especially the generally positive reception to women's suffrage in Dayton. Dayton was rich, it was sophisticated, and it was pretty progressive.
That's really interesting.
And I know maybe it sounds kind of condescending to put it that way, but I wouldn't expect that out of a town of its size in 1917. And that's
if you think about it, it's the town that produced Cox. Governor Cox was like the Dayton Daily News is still living with the legacy of his liberalism. We can't shake it, no matter how hard we try to tell readers like, well, we work on bias a lot. We don't think we are.
Yeah.
But a lot of readers are convinced we are because Governor Cox founded the paper, and Governor Cox was so progressive and so liberal.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a classic progressive back in that era. And he came from, this was the water he grew up in.
Right.
I guess that's not that much of a surprise.
Also, the degree, although I hoped to find more individual voices than I did, but the voices that I found, not just me, but those who were working with me, were themselves really fascinating. I'm sure if I'd found this at the time I was here for my last interviews, but I found a letter collection from a soldier who was in the 134th Field Artillery. He lived on Forest Avenue with his parents. Mm-hmm. He was a theology student at Ohio State.
Oh, my goodness.
Joined the YMCA and then joined the 134th. Mm-hmm. And on eBay, I found his letters and his diary and his dog tags and his wristwatch and the cigarette, the ashtray he made out of a German belt buckle.
Oh, my
Somebody
goodness.
Just dumped this on eBay, which was in itself kind of sad.
Right.
The diary on the outside said in clearly an old man's handwriting, "War diary, please do not throw away."
Oh, my goodness.
And managed to rescue all this stuff on eBay.
That's cool.
And it's beautiful. The letters themselves are absolutely fascinating. The stories of African American soldiers in the war, which just because the paper trail isn't quite the same as it is for white soldiers, harder to trace, but fascinating.
Right.
And in particular, to me, one of the stories, it wasn't a huge surprise to me, but I guess the degree was. We profiled the 372nd Infantry. Now, lately, there's been a lot of attention paid to the so-called Harlem Hellfighters, the 369th Infantry and the 93rd Division.
Right.
The 372nd was perhaps even more heavily decorated than the 369th.
Really?
It was a unit that was made up of African-American National Guard units from around the country, including what was... The so-called 9th Separate Battalion. The Army was strictly segregated by race. 9th Separate Battalion, Ohio National Guard. So we had a company, basically, of African-American men from Dayton who were in the 372nd. Was one of the black units that saw extensive combat because they were dumped on the French. White officers didn't want to serve with them. But the French
had no problem with it.
No, the French had no. French had colonials, the so-called colonial troops from Senegal and a number of other places, and had no problems. As a result, the 372nd, which fought very, very well under French direction, is one of the most heavily decorated units in the U.S. Army.
That's a fascinating story. What do you hope people will get out of the exhibit?
Well, two things. First of all, you know, that that the First World War shaped our country, shaped our city, shaped our lives in a way that we often don't remember. I mean, oftentimes people, I don't think, pay enough attention to history in general, obviously. That's kind of my profession, isn't it? But I think that, that the First World War in particular, the fact that it was a, in some ways, a more radically reshaping force than the Second World War. And just the fact that, you know, that we refer to the World War II generation as the greatest generation, without taking anything away from that, to keep in mind that the generation before went off to a war that was more mysterious and more frightening in some ways,
and more surprising.
More surprising.
They had no idea what they were going to expect,
with goals or aims that they weren't sure of.
Right.
And to come back, to find a country that was in economic distress, that their jobs were gone, their farms were foreclosed on, and as one author pointed out, if they thought they could take comfort in a glass of beer, that was going to be soon a pleasure
soon
to take away from them.
That's right.
Yes, and then they raised the greatest generation.
That's right.
The First World War is a moment in our history is something, and also that. How important Dayton was in the country and the world, even a century ago.
Right.
It's something we don't often think of, that it goes beyond the Wright brothers.
Well, I joked that it was the center of the universe, but it's not much of a joke.
No.
There was so much happening in Dayton in its heyday from like 1905 to about, 1930.
Yes,
that it was just remarkable. Like, so much of the world changed because of stuff that was happening here. The first of this, the first of that, the first of this, the first of that.
Yes,
there's so much of it.
Oh yeah,
and it's easy to forget. And it's one of the cool parts about living here, I think.
But,
real quick, we got like a minute or so left. Any other projects you're working on that you want to share?
The film is the next imminent one, and that's what I'm hoping for. I mean, hoping to get this done in the next couple of years. I've been thinking about it for a long time.
That's cool. Any other books in the works, or you mentioned?
Besides the Saratoga thing, which just came
Saratoga
up quickly,
right.
I'm working on a book on essentially Gangs of New York.
Oh, really?
I hate to use the movie name, but the what was going on in New York City in 1857.
Oh, wow!
Between the Dead Rabbits and the. And the nativists and the coming of age really of New York
City. And
that
is there when the movie is set, right?
It's supposed to start with the Rabbit Riot, even if it puts it actually a decade earlier than it actually happened.
But. Bill the Butcher.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a pretty hard movie to watch, actually.
It is.
I'm looking for, how many books do you,
I've got six books in print. Never mind.
Yeah. And how many do you juggle at a time? Do you normally juggle a screenplay in two different books?
I've done two books simultaneously.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay, cool. That's fabulous. Thanks for coming and talking to
us. Thanks, Ron. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, all right. So, let's recap. We've been here with Paul Lockhart, Wright State History Professor, member of the Dayton History Board of Trustees, and talking about the very cool, extremely educational, and well worth your time exhibition on Dayton's role in World War I, which is now at Carillon Historical Park in the back room by the carousel there. You can't miss it. It's a wonderful exhibit. And also, it'll be up through November 1918. So, thanks. Appreciate
Thank
it, Paul. Absolutely. Thanks for coming in. This has been Miami Valley Voices. I can say that. If you want to hear this show again later, it's available as a podcast on the WHIO.com homepage. Thanks. Have a great Sunday. See you next week.